Matthew 24. We are ready for Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22. We have said in the preceding verses that Jesus has stated a lot of things about Jerusalem's destruction in 70 AD. He talked about back there in verse 2, no stone would be left on top of one another, the false predictions about the false Christ in verses 5 and 6, or 4 and 5 actually. We'll see that again this evening. Nation was going to rise against nation. There would be earthquakes in various places. There would be famines, a great deal of persecution and so forth. But people needed to endure if they wanted to preserve their lives. Verse 13, and then we talked about the gospel being spread. Verse 14, the abomination of desolation. We went through that last Wednesday night. And then he said in verses 16 and 17, if you're in the area of Judea, you need to flee to the mountains. Don't go down into the house and take anything. We mentioned the flat roofs. They, of course, would have allowed people to go from one roof to another very easily and then make their way out of the city. I didn't mention one thing to you so far, but you have the Romans attacking Jerusalem. But there was also, and we'll add to this a little bit later in the class, but there was also another issue. Anybody remember the Jewish party, the Zealots? Well, there was a Jewish party known as the Zealots. Simon the Canaanitean, or Simon the Zealot, seems to have been part of that group. Anybody know what the Zealots were for? They were the rabble-rousers. They were the insurrectionists. They were people that were not the nicest folks in the world. If the reports about Jerusalem's destruction are true, the Zealots were there inside the city of Jerusalem. And if you have that mindset of you're an insurrectionist, or you are really geared towards battle and fighting, and you've got people fleeing out the back door, as someone who has the mentality, let's stay and fight, what are you thinking about these guys that are fleeing? Just let them go? Probably not. If you want to stand and fight, you're looking for everybody you can get, right? So there also seems to have been some issues with the Zealots. They're there inside the city of Jerusalem. They're trying to keep people there as well. And that was one of the reasons why, as we went back to Luke 21, within the last week or two, Jesus said, if you're outside the city of Jerusalem, you don't want to come back in. You don't want to seek out the fortification from this place. Now, we've said it was bad. We've said it was awful. We've said it was terrible and horrific. And now tonight, we're going to further probe verses 21 and 22 in Matthew 24 to show why exactly that was the case. Then 21 says, for then shall be great tribulation, such as hath not been from the beginning of the world until now, no, nor ever shall be. Then 22, and except those days had been shortened, no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, those days shall be shortened. Jesus, as he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, point number one, he describes it as a great tribulation. And when we think about the word tribulation, we're thinking about, in this case, a siege, the calamities of war. And Jesus said, if you go back all the way to the beginning, there has, up to that time, never been anything like he described here. He said there would not be anything in his day, in that first generation time period, that would be this bad. And then he looked forward throughout human history, the rest of human history, and said that nothing ever will be as bad as what happened to Jerusalem. Now, one of the things, as you look at 21 and 22, 22 especially, it's helpful, and we've made this point as we go through the text, and I think it's worth pausing here for just a moment as well. He says, and except those days, plural. Well, a lot of people, when they come to this passage, we've said before, they'll try to use this to describe end of time, the Lord's going to come and this is going to happen. But as we've said before, it's days, it's plural. But when the Lord comes back, it's not going to be a period of days. It's going to be, as Paul says in 1 Corinthians 15, like the blinking of the eye, and things will be wrapped up very, very quickly. Then, Don?
Are you saying that the great tribulation is referring to Christians only?
I'm defining the great tribulation as the destruction of Jerusalem. And that destruction of Jerusalem, Jesus says nothing up to that time had been as bad as the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 A.D., and then as he continues with the verse, he really goes from the beginning of creation all the way to the end. And he says there, as you look at human history, will never be anything as bad as this. We're going to say a little bit more about that. I think I know where you're going with the question, but if you just hold on to that for a bit and then kind of see what we're going to experience a little later in the class. Let's talk for just a second about the word tribulation. A lot of times this word gets people worked up. They're going to talk about some future tribulation. There's going to be some great tribulation. But when you go back and you look at the Bible, the word that's translated tribulation here is used quite often in the scriptures. Do you remember from the parable on the sower, Matthew 13, verse 21, Jesus said there's some people who fall away. Well, based on what we've seen in Matthew 24, what do you think one of those reasons for apostasy is? People experience tribulation. Now, that's not necessarily the tribulation that was associated with the destruction of Jerusalem, but it is tribulation in a general sense. And the Lord said that's going to cause some people throughout time to stumble. John 16, verse 33 has the same word. Jesus said, in the world, you're going to face tribulation. You're going to face various hardships. It's going to be discouraging. Acts 11, 19, Paul, four times in the book of Romans. Romans 2, verse 9, Romans 5, 3, Romans 8, 35, and also Romans 12, 12. And none of these passages deal with some kind of end time information or material, but it does use in these four passages the word that's translated tribulation. Paul, remember the 1 Corinthians 7 chapter where he talks about marriage? He talks about the great distress, or he talks about the tribulation the Corinthians were going through. Well, it was a bad time. Not the destruction of Jerusalem there, but it was very, very difficult for the people. And John uses this word at various times in the book of Revelation. Now, as Jesus talks about this great tribulation, I'd like to have somebody flip over to Mark chapter 13, verse 19. This is an incidental point, but it demonstrates for us the value of comparing the multiple accounts that we have, because sometimes you'll see some details slipped into these other accounts that we don't find in Matthew 24. Somebody have it? Mark 13, verse 19. All right, Sherman's got it. Thank you.
For in those days there will be tribulation, such as has not been seen the beginning of the creation, which God created until this time, or ever shall be.
Okay. Now, Jesus, did he believe in a creation? That's what he says, Mark 13, 19. Now, he kind of slips this in when he's talking about the destruction of Jerusalem, and that's why I say this is a quick side point that's off the beaten path a little bit. But sometimes when the Lord discusses these kinds of things, you may remember, for example, when he talked about marriage back in Matthew 19, he talks about the beginning, you know, the way things were initially. So Jesus, in the discussion about Jerusalem and its destruction, he mentions specifically that the earth is here, not by chance, not by, you know, a random series of events, but the Lord specifically said that we are here by a creation. All right, now back on point for a second. Jesus, as he talks about the destruction of Jerusalem, says that it's going to be as bad as anything the world has ever said. If the historical records are right, and some of this material comes from Josephus, Josephus says that 1.1 million Jews were killed. Now you think about that. Over a million people were killed. And then he says 97,000 were taken captive. Now, in addition to what Josephus and some other historical records claim, let's see what Jesus says, because the Lord's statement in Luke 21, verses 23 and 24, the end of verse 23 and all of verse 24, seem to line up very well with what Josephus records. Sometimes historical numbers can be fuzzy. Sometimes people inflate things. But the Lord in Luke 21 makes it clear that this was really, really bad. Somebody want to take care of that for us? Luke 21? Verses 23 and 24. Josh.
But woe to those who are pregnant and to those who are nursing babies in those days, for there will be great distress in the land and wrath upon his people. And they will fall by the edge of the sword and be led away and captured into all nations, and Jerusalem will be trampled by Gentiles until the times of the Gentiles are fulfilled.
All right. Jerusalem is going to be trampled. The Lord talked about the death of people and also people being carried away. And this is what happened. People may want to dispute or refute some of the numbers, but definitely there were people killed and people were taken captive. The people who were taken captive, many of them were used for slaves. Some of them were used to work in mines. Others were used for gladiatorial games in places like Caesarea. If you go back and you look at the number of people, Hiroshima was not all that long ago. What they did with the nuclear device that was detonated there, if you go back and you look at the numbers, it was really four times, if Josephus is right, four times the number of people that died in Hiroshima died when Jerusalem was attacked by the Romans. And it was really, really bad. There are a couple of reasons for that. The Romans came at Passover time, so you have a feast. It's just like today. When there is a big event, people will flock into an area. We see here some of the festivals. Festival here in Indiana or a festival over there in Michigan, people from outside the area will come, so a town is literally overflowing with people. Then you also have what we talked about last week from Luke 21. If you're out there in the rural area, you've got some farmers, you've got some other people that are in outlying villages, When you get word that the Romans are headed to town, where are you going to go? You're going to stay out in your farm? Where are you going to head looking for safety? Well, you might go to the mountains if you have sense. But, right, other people would go to the fortified city. Let's go to the walled city of Jerusalem. But the Lord specifically warned against that and said, do not do that. That's going to be the wrong choice, as we saw from Luke 21, verse 21. Now, as Jesus makes this claim in Matthew 24, verses 21 and 22, notice what he doesn't claim. Does the Lord claim that more people were going to die in this battle than any other? He doesn't claim that. Now, if he had made that claim, would his prediction have been wrong?
Yes.
Yeah, I would say so. And I think, Don, maybe this gets into where you were talking about just a moment ago. What other military campaigns, if we can style it in that way, what other kinds of warfare have resulted in more deaths than a million people? Well, okay, I'm not sure how many died, but it was a ton of people. So maybe the Civil War. We certainly know with what happened with the Nazis, the death concentration camps. Anybody remember the number there that's floated around? About 6 million people. So if a million people or 1.1 million died in Jerusalem, it would have been wrong for Jesus to say that this is going to cause the most deaths. Because you do have that. You have some other things, I think. Under Stalin's rule, when we think about Russia, it's reported there that over his reign of terror, about 20 million Jews died. So there have been at least two, three, and maybe more situations throughout human history where more people have died as far as the number of people. But let me make one of the quick points, Steve, and then I'm going to take your hand there. What's different about these things with Stalin and the Nazis and maybe the Civil War and Jerusalem? Well, okay, there would have been that. When we're talking about Jerusalem, though, how would that be different or distinct from what happened with Germany? Knocking off 6 million people, did they all come from the same city? Not with the Nazis. You know, you may have a whole country, several areas, but it's spread over there. But when you're thinking about Jerusalem, you're talking about over a million people in basically one location. And that's one of the things that makes this very, very distinct. So let's make sure that we make that distinction. Steve?
Well, it's sort of like you were talking about. I was wondering how many people might have been on the earth at that time. 1.1 million people out of that time, that's a big percentage of the Earth's population.
And that would be,
I don't know what it was, but it's not as much, you know, as many as this is.
Definitely right. And that may be one of the other reasons why Jesus talks about this, because if you were to break it down as far as the percentage of people who lived on the earth and the percentage of that died compared to now, yes, I think you're exactly right that would also be true. Don?
Going back to the tribulation term in verse 24 of Mark 13.
Okay, 13:24. I've got to turn over there.
But in those days, after that tribulation, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give light, and the stars will be falling from heaven and the powers in heaven will be shaken.
Yes. When you go back to the Old Testament, and we'll see a little bit of this in the book of Revelation, but when you go back to the Old Testament, you find that language being used to describe the overthrow of nations. Let's see if we've got a couple cross-references there. Should be able to pull out one from Isaiah, or a couple from Isaiah. Yes, I'm not putting verse 26 at the end of time. I'm also putting 26 as a passage which deals with the destruction of Jerusalem. But let's not get too far ahead on that. Let's just hold that. I don't have there a cross-reference. Let's see if we've got here in the back. Maybe somebody can help me check a concordance if you have one. Sun, moon, stars. We have similar language in Acts 2, but I was looking for an Old Testament passage. Uh, Acts 2, 19 and 20, I'll show wonders in the heaven above, signs in the earth beneath, blood, fire, vapor of smoke, the sun shall be turned into darkness, and the moon into blood, and so forth. Let's see. But God used this language to describe the overthrow of a lot of different nations. Egypt, Babylon, Assyria. Let me check Joel 2:31. Well, that would have been from Acts 2, Joel 2:31. I can get you that reference a little bit later, but right now, Don, there are several of them. I can't give you the exact passages in the Old Testament, but that language is used to describe that kind of thing. Going back to what we were talking about just a moment ago, as well as far as why this was such a bad thing, as you look at the historical records, it said that 30,000 young Jewish boys were crucified on the city walls and in the surrounding areas. The reports say that so many people were crucified that they had cut down all the green trees, the lumber stores that they had gone through all the woods, all the wood that was there. And just think about how bad that would be. You know, you're walking by and you see 30,000 young, presumably reasonably healthy males crucified on the city walls. And it was a lot worse than that, as we're going to get into tonight. But you may remember from Matthew 27, verse 25, there at the end of the Lord's life, the Jewish people said, "Let Jesus' blood be on whose heads? On our heads and on the heads of our children." Now, when you make that kind of statement to God, God's listening. In this particular case, it took about 40 years. But likely some of the people who made that statement were still alive. Certainly their children would have been alive at this time, and that is precisely what happened. The city was also kind of a madhouse, because as you go back and you look at the records of what was taking place, you have, if you can think of, Jerusalem, that's just considered as a box, and you've got four corners in that box. They also, according to reports, had four warring factions. So you're trying to fight the Romans on the outside, and then you're also trying to fight inside. You've got the zealots there, and it really would not have been a well-orchestrated battle from the Jewish perspective. It really was a mess. Josephus, again, going back to one of the reports that he gave, and I'm going to read this. It's a little long, but it illustrates for us. It's gross, but it illustrates for us just how awful this was. There was a woman, cultured woman, very wealthy lady. By that day and time standard, she would have had all that people probably could have possessed, but she experienced a robbery during the siege, and after this lady experienced that robbery and basically lost what she had, here's the quote. "She attempted a most unnatural thing. And snatching up her son, who was a child sucking at her breast, she said, 'O thou miserable infant, for whom shall I preserve thee in this war, this famine, this sedition?' As to the war with the Romans, if they preserve our lives, we must be their slaves." Well, she was perceptive enough on that point to conclude what was right, as we said earlier. 97,000 people were taken to be slaves. "This famine will also destroy us even before the slavery comes upon us. Yet are these seditious rogues more terrible than both the other? Come on. Now, speaking of her child or infant, be thou my food, and be thou a fury to these seditious people, and a byword to the world, which is all that is now wanting to complete the calamities of us Jews." As soon as she said this, she slew her son, and then roasted him, and ate the one half of him, and kept the other half by her concealed. Upon this, the seditious came in presently, and smelling the horrid scent of this food, they threatened her that they would cut her throat immediately if she did not show them what food she had gotten ready. She replied that she had saved a very fine portion of it for them, and withal uncovered what was left of her son. Hereupon they were seized with horror and amazement of mind, and stood astonished at the sight, when she said to them, 'This is mine own son, and what hath been done was mine own doing. Come, eat of this food, for I have eaten of it myself. Do not you pretend to be either more tender than a woman, or more compassionate than a mother. But if you are so scrupulous and do abominate this my sacrifice as I have eaten the one half, let the rest be reserved for me also.' After which those men went out trembling, being never so much affrighted at anything as they were at this, and with some difficulty they left the rest of that meat to the mother. Upon which the whole city," notice this, "upon which the whole city was full of this horrid action immediately." Now, you might say that this one woman was just a crazy lady who was possessed with hunger. But the way that Josephus describes this is that this became a city-wide phenomenon. Now, I cannot, as I look through human history, and I'm no history expert by any means, but I cannot think of any time in history that I've ever heard of where it became, we might say, commonplace for mothers to kill their children and then eat them. I mean, people have done some barbaric things, but this was really, really bad. And that's exactly what Jesus said in Matthew 24. Continuing, so thus that were thus distressed by the famine were very desirous to die. And those already dead were esteemed happy because they had not lived long enough either to hear or to see such miseries. And then he says, after which these men went out trembling, being never so much affrighted at anything as they were at this. And with some difficulty, they left the rest of that meat to the mother. Then Josephus goes on to speak about some other things. There are some indications that as people were eating, you know, imagine, you know, being out in a restaurant with your family and somebody has just, you know, taken a good bite, you know, of a Whopper or something else. And, I mean, it's just going into the mouth and another family member grabs that morsel of food because they're so hungry. I mean, it's the father, he grabs it out of the wife's mouth, or maybe an infant has been given something to eat and the parent is so hungry, well, hey, I need it worse than you do. And they grab the food from that infant. He talked about the old men who held their food fast. He says they were beaten as the people were searching for food. And if the women hid what they had within their hands, their hair was torn for so doing. People lifted up children from the ground and shook them down upon the floor. And he talks about some other things that I think are probably too nasty to mention in class, but some torture methods were used to try to get people to deliver up information as far as where the food was stored. So it was really, really bad. Now, somebody might write all this off and say, well, you know, this is just a bunch of historical information, and it's not in the Bible, and we just don't think it was that bad. Well, I found this passage, I don't know, maybe 8 or 10 years ago, and connected it with the destruction of Jerusalem. Let's go back as a class to Deuteronomy 28, verses 52 to 53. It seems to me that in Deuteronomy 28, verses 52 and 53, we have a passage that was written about 1,500 years prior to the time of Jerusalem's destruction. And everything that I have looked at indicates that this passage, these two verses, look forward to what we're talking about tonight, the destruction of Jerusalem. Anybody want to read it? Deuteronomy 28, Brian, verses 52 and 53.
And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates until thy high and fenced walls come down, wherein thou trustest, throughout all thy land. And he shall besiege thee in all thy gates throughout all thy land, which the Lord thy God hath given thee. And thou shalt eat the fruit of thy own body, the flesh of thy sons and of thy daughters, which the Lord thy God hath given thee, in the siege and in the straitness wherewith thine enemy shall distress thee.
Okay, especially verse 53. That passage is very, very clear. Not just one situation, but Jesus specifically talks about multiple people who would eat the flesh of their sons and of their daughters because the siege that was taking place, I believe in 70 AD, it was going to be that bad. So when Jesus says this is going to be something unlike the world has ever seen, that seems to be literally true. It was, like I say, so bad that in some respects we don't want to mention some of the things that were associated with it, but it comes right out in Deuteronomy 28 and says that this was going to occur. Then one other quick point, and we'll see if there's anything that you want to add or ask. Titus, he was the leader of the opposition here. He was the chief attacker from Rome. Titus, in going his rounds along those valleys, saw them full of dead bodies, and the thick putrefaction running about them, he gave a groan. And spreading out his hands to heaven, called God to witness that this was not his doing. And such was the sad case of the city itself. Now, when you have the bad guy spreading out his arms and saying to God, this is not my doing. And this was a fellow who would have seen a lot of bloodshed and a lot of battle, very familiar with military campaigns. It reinforces what Jesus was saying here. And it was one more way for God to say to the Jewish people, you're done. You have rejected my son. You have brought this awful tragedy upon yourselves because you have rejected me. And now I'm going to completely demonstrate just how finished you are. There was nothing left after this for the Jews to use as far as worship, was related to the Jewish faith. And it really was consistent with what Jesus described in Matthew 24, verse 2. He said, all the stones are going to be torn down. The whole place is going to be completely devastated. Anything that you want to add or ask before we make a couple more points? Right. You have a couple of things that might be related to that. There was a story about Solomon and his, you know, deciding.
I think that one died, though.
Yes, that one died. Yes. Right. And in just, if you look at those situations, and there probably have been a few other times in human history where somebody has been that desperate, but never that desperate on a widespread scale. And yet, that's one of the things that seems to have made the destruction of Jerusalem so ghastly. You know, people were willing to do that and willing to do that. I mean, Deuteronomy 28, it specifically talks about sons, plural, daughters, plural, their own flesh and blood. So it was as gross and as bad and as vile as we can imagine for all the reasons that we've given, plus some that we haven't. So just really, really a horrible thing. Anything else before we talk about the elect? Okay. As you look here, what Jesus said in 21 and 22, 22 especially, he says, and except those, here's our plural again, except those days had been shortened. It was so bad that Jesus said no flesh would have been saved. But for the elect's sake, who do you think the elect are? Christians, God's people. Church had been established about 40 years prior to this time. Except for the elect's sake, the Lord said, those days were going to be shortened. Well, that is exactly right. The siege against Jerusalem had lasted about 5 months. And if you had a month of this, that would have been bad. 2 or 3 months, 4 months would have been unthinkable. But by the time you get to the 5 month period, it's like we're going to be wiped out if something doesn't happen. Well, something did happen. Titus, he brought his soldiers against the area of Jerusalem, against the city of Jerusalem, and he decided initially that he was going to starve them out by famine. So he builds a wall around the city. Now, if you're going to try to drive people out or kill people by famine, you think it's going to be a short process, or you think it's going to be a long process? It's going to be a long, drawn-out process. And that's why Josephus talks about people, you know, shaking their kids. They were looking for food, grabbing food out of the mouths of people. But still, you know, people can hold out, you know, even if they've got nothing but bread or maybe just water, they can still hold out for a little while. But things began to change. You find that the Jewish people, they decided to try to stave off the force. There was an attack that was mounted. The Romans were able to break into the city, and Titus was also needed back home. So there's kind of a quick mop-up operation. And what would have been that protracted battle because of the famine and so forth, because of the circumstances that took place, the Romans were able to get in the city, Titus is called back home, it was reduced to a period of about 5 months. Well, Jesus said he did that for the sake of the elect, for the sake of his people. It's a principle or it's a teaching that's found elsewhere. Remember back in Genesis 18, it's about verse 32? Abraham is asking for God to save... Genesis 18. Abraham is asking God, okay, you've got the people there in the area of Sodom. Starts out with how many? If they're 50. And finally, by the time we get down to the point that we're talking about God, if there are...
Five.
No, not five. If there are 10 righteous people in the city, what was going to save that city? What was going to preserve that area? Righteous people. Righteous people had an effect. In this case, it wasn't really a nation, but it was an effect on the people in that area. Well, righteous people, Matthew 24. Did they also have an effect on the area of Jerusalem? Jesus said the days, because of the elect, because of the righteous, the days are going to be shortened. It's not going to be as bad as it could be. Thus, as we look at this information, we find that as we look at God's people, if they're trying to live the kind of life that they should live, they can help preserve the lifespan of a nation and even its prosperity. Mark's account of this, if somebody turn over to Mark 13, verse 20, we have here one more little detail. Mark also talks about the elect, but then he says something else about them. Mark 13, verse 20. Jeff.
And if the Lord had not cut short the days, no human being would be saved. But for the sake of the elect, whom he chose, he shortened the days.
Okay. Now, we already have talked about the elect because of Matthew 24. But now as we look at this additional information, what's the other point that is made known here? The elect who are chosen. Well, how are they chosen? Why are they chosen? Is it the idea of Calvinism that God simply said, I like you and I'm going to choose you for salvation in heaven? I don't like you, therefore I'm not going to choose you. What's he mean by the choosing?
People's choice, your own choice.
Okay. We have to leave free will in that because man does have the ability to choose. Joshua, a long time ago, gave that principle. He said, choose you this day who you're going to serve. You can choose, as me and my house have chosen, to serve God, or you can serve the other pagan gods. The book of Revelation, one of the final things that we read in that book is, whosoever will may come. So all people have the ability to choose. They're given that freedom, that right. So what's he mean when he says God has done the choosing? Old preachers described it in this way, and I think it's a pretty good way. God did not arbitrarily choose people, but he did choose classes. He chose the righteous class to have what with him? Fellowship. He chose the unrighteous class to have separation from him. In this particular case, hell. It's hell. So that's one of the things I think that we should remember. We also, in addition to remembering that man has free will, God has foreknowledge. Isaiah 46:10 tells us that God declares the end, the conclusion, from when?
Beginning.
The beginning. So he knows how things are going to go, but at the same time, he still gives us free will. And that's why John, in places like Revelation 17, was able to say the names are written in the Lamb's Book of Life from what point? From the foundation of the world. Well, didn't our parents make some choices when it came to having kids? You know, they didn't. God didn't force them to have us. They made some choices. They made some choices about marriage. They made some choices about when to have children and so forth. Free will there was exercised, but God knew the choices that people were going to make. Okay, anything that you want to discuss before we start into verses 23 through 26? Don?
The siege of Jerusalem by the Romans wasn't the only incident in the Israelite history where cannibalism was supernatural, was it?
Like I say, you can go back, and I think there's the one instance that you have that Virginia cited.
Babylonians?
Wait, I thought you mentioned Israelite history. Okay, yeah. But if we're specifically talking about the people of Israel involved in cannibalism,
Second Kings 6:28-29.
Okay. Okay, Samaria, Elisha, king of Israel passing by upon the wall, there quite a woman in him. Yes, and that's one Virginia was referencing. I believe. Let's see. King said to her, "What aileth thee?" She answered, "Give thy son that we may eat him today, and we will eat my son tomorrow." So we boiled. This is the point, 29. So we boiled my son and did eat him. And I said unto her on the next day, "Give thy son that we may eat him." And she hath hid her son. So there you have an example of one person being, one child being eaten. And there were, if you want to use the word threats, or there, at least there was a conversation about eating more.
Well, I'm referring back to Deuteronomy, which is way before
right.
Second Kings. That could refer to that one as well as it did. Not that it didn't refer to Jerusalem, but it could,
right.
could refer to that too.
Yeah. Like I said, there is sometimes information in the Bible that has more than one fulfillment. One of the things that sticks with me about Deuteronomy, though, as we go back to 52 and 53, he talks about, "They shall besiege thee in all thy gates, until thy high and fortified walls come down." Now that sure seems to point to a later time in Hebrew history, and that would be consistent with the destruction of Jerusalem. But we do have, as you mentioned, and as Virginia noted, the example over there in the book of Kings, 2 Kings, and it really got bad by the time we get to 70 AD. So I mean, it's gross, whether it's one or whether it's 100. But this is where people get very, very desperate. So thank you very much for pulling out that reference. Todd?
Just throwing this out there, but if God, if the Jews are God's chosen people, and he destroyed that many, why let the world go on? And, I mean, if he knows what's going to happen to the end of time, why let it go on?
Let me make a couple of points about that, and if these don't fully or adequately answer that question, we'll pick it up again. When we think about God's chosen people, they had been his people for a long time. At least 2,000 years. things kind of start out there with Abraham, and they end up where you've got God's people out there in the land of Canaan. God gave them a religion that was intended or designed to last for a period of time. But as Galatians 3 says, till the seed should come. Who was that seed that should come? Christ. He's the Messiah. So God created this system, and it was to last until the seed shall come. If we put this in terms of a person who has worked at a company for a long time, and you've done a good job, but this company changes its system, whether it's the manufacturing end of the system or maybe whether it's the administration that's being done, and it is a drastically new system. The old employee, though, refuses to change. I've been doing it this way for 45 years. I'm always going to do it this way. What's the company going to say? No, we've changed. And the old system is out. You can't use it anymore if you want to work here. Well, that's really what God did with the Jewish system. It was in place for a long time till the seed came and the Lord established a new system. Well, God was gracious in that even though the new system was created around 30 AD, from 30 AD to 40 AD, how many years do we have? Roughly 40. And God said, I'm going to give you a period of 40 years to get this figured out. But 40 years after Christ came into the world, there were many people who were still relying on animal sacrifices, many people who were still trying to look back to Moses, many people who would not follow the New Testament, they were still committed to the old. And God finally said, what do I have to do? If you're not going to get with the program after 4 years, you've got to go. I've got to go ahead and completely dismantle the system. And he did. He brought the Romans in, and I mean, he just wiped the place clean. So that would be the best illustration off the... Okay.
The rest of the countries, they're not following God. They're following all other gods, aren't they?
Yeah. You still have the paganism. God dealt with them in various ways. But for the Jewish people, back in John 1, maybe this passage will... the Lord came unto his own, and they received him not. It's John 1, verse 11. He, or Jesus, came unto his own, and they that were his own received him not. Now imagine that. God sends not just a prophet, doesn't send an apostle or a great servant of God, but who does God send to his people? The image of God, a member of the Godhead. And these people say, we don't want you. Not only did they say, we don't want you, we don't want your religion, what are we going to do to you? We're going to grind you into the dust. We're going to crucify you. Now, worshiping a pagan god is bad. No doubt about that. But they didn't have the experience where they were God's people. They had received direct revelation from God. They had the Son of God, deity in the flesh, come down and live among them for 3.5 years. They saw the miracles. They heard the teachings. They couldn't refute the teachings that he offered. And they basically at the end said, we're not only rejecting you, we're going to put you to the death in the worst way that a person can be crucified. And once you begin to rub God's nose in it to that degree, then God says, I'm going to be gracious for a while longer. 40 more years I'll also give you. Which, when we think about God's grace and mercy, that was incredibly gracious. But if they were going to continue to rebel, God finally said, the plug is being pulled. And it's going to be utter decimation. So that would be one of the ways that I would distinguish between the people of Israel and the other nations who were doing some bad things and why they were hit so hard. Okay. Anybody else? All right, let's take the remainder of the time that we have and at least start with verses 23 through 26 in Matthew 24. I've got to get out of the book of John and get back over to the right spot. In 23, he says, then if any man shall say unto you, lo, here is the Christ, or here, believe it not. For there shall arise false Christs and false prophets and shall show great signs and wonders, so as to lead astray, if possible, even the elect. Behold, I have told you beforehand. If therefore they shall say unto you, behold, he is in the wilderness, go not forth. Behold, he is in the inner chambers, believe it not. The word then, in verse 23, connects this material to what has already been said. Jesus talked about the abomination of desolation back there in verse 15. As we mentioned, the fleeing to the mountains, pray that it's not going to be on the winter, pray that it's not going to, or pray that it won't be in the winter, or that it will not be on a Sabbath day, and so forth. The days being shortened. And then verse 23, he says, then, still connecting this with the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. Now, Jesus knew that things were going to be so traumatic. And if you can imagine the kinds of things that we talked about earlier, when Rome comes and people are starting to eat their children and all the other difficulties that we talked about, you're thinking, this has got to be the end. You know, what can be worse than this? What can follow this? It's got to be the end of the world. And Christians might have been wondering about those things as well. So Jesus comes to this section of his sermon, his teaching, and says, I want you to know, verses 23 and 24, that people are going to be making claims. They're going to be making false claims related to what part of life? The spiritual, the religious part of life. And Jesus indicated that as we look at the time of Jerusalem's destruction, some people were going to be claiming to perform signs, they were going to be claiming to be the Messiah and so forth. And this was so important, as I mentioned at the start of the class, Jesus dealt with this earlier. If you move back to verses 4 and 5, the Lord said there, take heed that no man lead you astray. Many are going to come in my name, saying that I am the Christ, and lead many astray. Then also in verse 11, and many false prophets shall arise. And Jesus there also said that many would leave people astray. One man who offered a paraphrase of this makes the point very well with this rather loose rendering. He says, fake messiahs and lying preachers are going to pop up everywhere. Their impressive credentials and dazzling performance will pull the wool over the eyes of even those who ought to know better. Now, that's not quite what the Lord said, but that gives you a general gist of the point that he's trying to make. When troublesome times come, when war comes, if you look at some of the things that have taken place now in areas like Afghanistan and Iraq and even Egypt, there's chaos in the streets. What are people looking for? Well, okay, but as people start scattering and as there is the division and there's the chaos, who do people want?
They want order. They want security.
All right, they want security, and often that takes the form of a leader. If there was someone who rises up and says, I'll help you, well, he may not have the right ideas, but a lot of people will fall in, you know, behind him, and then he will lead them either maybe to victory or maybe to more to worse times or maybe even defeat. And that seems to be part of the idea here. False messiahs, either they were claiming that they were Jesus, he'd returned, or they would be claiming to, you know, be a replacement messiah, or they would have the credentials, the ability to lead people out of difficulty. Now, at the end of verse 24, Jesus talked about great signs and wonders, signs that would be so notable that even the elect, he said, might be tempted to accept them. Jesus did not say, and I'm not going to venture a guess, as to whether or not these signs were genuine or whether or not they were just good fakes. It really doesn't matter, because whichever way he meant, maybe both, that the end result is the same, that these people were not genuine, they really were not performing signs from God. And it's a point that we can apply to our day and time. You think people still offer false signs? Yeah. And you think people are still sometimes led astray by what people claim? Absolutely. So the kind of thing that we see today, different set of circumstances than what we have in Matthew 24, but the principle is still the same. People need to be warned about religious error, a lot of which masquerades as Christianity. Another thing that, as you look at these verses, that really stands out to me is that people sometimes today will make predictions. But when we look at the predictions made by Jesus, how specific are they? They're pretty specific. He talks about false Christs or false messiahs. He talks about the signs. He talks about the wonders we're going to be doing. And then he will even say in verse 25, if therefore they shall say unto you, he's where? In the wilderness. Or some others might say he's in secret chambers, the inner chambers, private places. So the Lord, as he talks about what his people were going to experience, he was pretty specific as far as offering some almost point-blank prophecies. Well, rather than let his people try to figure out this stuff, when it came, Jesus says, I'm telling you when. Now, I'm telling you in advance, I'm giving you this information beforehand, so you don't get caught up in the counterfeit signs of false messiahs. And that tells us today that God's people should also be well-grounded in God's word so that they can, you know the truth about signs and there not being any more apostles, prophets, messiahs, those kinds of things. Two, when God tells us things beforehand, what does that eliminate? People will sometimes say, oh, I'm not accountable because I didn't know. Nobody told me. Did God tell people about what was going to take place here? Absolutely. He's very specific. And he's given us today the specific information that we know to still avoid the things that are contrary to his word. Verse 26, let's squeeze this in as well quickly, reinforces the fact that a lot of people would claim to be the Lord or the Messiah, and some would be saying that he was out in the wilderness, others that he would be in the inner or secret chambers. That, of course, would seem to refer to the temple. Now, these, again, were ways of distinguishing Jesus from these pretenders. When you look at the Lord, did he spend a bunch of his time when he got to his public ministry out in the wilderness? Or was he there among the people? He was there among the people. Did Jesus, in his public ministry, hide in the temple, in the inner courts? No, he was out there teaching publicly in the temple courts. Thus, if people were to say, well, Jesus has come back. Well, that's not the same Jesus that was here before. He's not doing the same kinds of things. And then, two, you might consider this as well. If you were going to be a false prophet or a false Messiah, where would be the most dangerous place for you to be? In public or in private? Public. How come? All right, people can ask you questions. People can check you out. But if you're hiding in the closet somewhere, a little difficult to find. And this would be one more sign that these people were not going to be open, they were not going to be forthright, they were not going to put themselves in a position where their claims could be easily checked. One source said, "The work of God is honest and can be done where all may see it." That is exactly right.